Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, our conversation about Jihad Rehab, a move in Saudi Arabia to deprogram al-Qaeda operatives and other convicted terrorists. But first, Mercedes and Jeeps are about as different as two cars can get, which is probably why the marriage between the two has failed. Germany's Daimler-Benz bought Chrysler for $36 billion in 1998. Today, the business world is reacting to the news that Daimler will sell its controlling interest in Chrysler for a mere $7.4 billion. The buyer is the private equity firm Cerberus Capital Management, making Chrysler the first of the major Detroit carmakers to become privately owned. And here with what that might mean is Micheline Maynard of the New York Times. Mickey, Cerberus is buying an 80% stake in the company they'll now call Chrysler Holding Company. What's been the reaction to this news?
Well, there's been a really immediate reaction to this, and I think the reaction is that, you know, this could be the end of Chrysler as we know it, and I actually think it's going to be the end of Detroit as the sort of unified, monolithic automotive entity, because now we have private equity coming in. Until now, Detroit companies have been either public companies or had a heavily family orientation like the Ford Motor Company. You know, back in the early days, there were entrepreneurs that founded these companies, but then they took them public. Mm-hmm. This is going to be the first time in literally decades that there's been a privately held auto industry company. And, you know, that's going to put a curtain over one of the most important companies in America.
Right. They won't have oversight from stockholders. And there are concerns that more and more private equity companies are buying companies and stripping them of assets.
Well, I think that's always been the concern, especially by union members, that the company could be what UAW President Ron Gettelfinger called stripped and flipped. That the idea is that private equity companies aren't in here to be nice to you. They're in here to make a profit. So I think there is concern that something like Jeep, something like the dealership network, even the building where Chrysler does business, you know, down the road could be put up for sale. Now, the head of Cerberus, John Snow, the former Treasury Secretary, said that's absolutely not the case, that he's in it for the long haul, and that's what he plans to prove, is that they want to preserve the future of Chrysler.
Well, Ron Gettelfinger is also quoted in your article as saying that the deal is in the best interest of UAW workers. He's come to that conclusion. But you also quote a financial expert, David Cole, as saying the union is in a horrifying box right now.
One of the things here is the total reversal that the UAW has shown over the last month. Just a month ago, Mr. Gettelfinger said that he would try to get other unions to fight this deal. Then he came out when the deal was announced and said it's in the best interest of the workers. And what we don't understand is what changed in a month's time.
Well, the deal is expected to be finalized in the third quarter. As we said, Cerberus paying far less than Daimler did in 1998. And Daimler says it's also going to end up losing an additional $650 million. So explain the math for us. Why would Daimler agree to this money-losing deal?
Well, the big reason is that the Cerberus-owned Chrysler will take $18 billion in pension and health care liabilities with it. And that's not an unfunded amount. Chrysler actually has been paying its health care, paying its pensions, but it's a disadvantage, they say, vis-a-vis the Japanese automakers who don't have those kinds of health care plans and pension plans for their workers in the United States. And in other parts of the world, of course, workers receive government health care. So Daimler Chrysler was just really happy to get that off of its books, and
right,
it was willing to take a small loss on Chrysler in order to do that.
Back in February, there was a restructuring plan, and 13,000 jobs were cut in the Chrysler division. You've said that the head of Cerberus says that, you know, there won't be much bloodletting, but you've also said that people think that whole divisions might go within Chrysler. So what's the thought of more job cuts?
For the moment, Daimler Chrysler executives are saying there aren't any more job cuts planned. But when the restructuring plan was announced earlier this year, people looked at that and said, is that really deep enough for a true turnaround at Chrysler? And it's very possible that that could be revisited down the road.
Well, Mickey, you're there in Detroit. How are people reacting, you know, on the street to this news?
You know, Chrysler's been such a roller coaster ride. You think about the bailout in 1979.
Lee Iacocca.
With Lee Iacocca. You think about the sale to the Germans in 1998. And now we've had Chrysler sold. And you know, it really is frayed nerves. And mm-hmm. People just here have to hang on for the ride and watch history in the making.
Mickey Maynard covers the auto industry for the New York Times. She's been speaking about the sale of Chrysler to a private equity company. It's expected, as we said, to be finalized in the third quarter of the year. Mickey, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, a new car and $18,000. They are just two of the parting gifts given to some graduates of a jihadi rehabilitation program in Saudi Arabia. Much like a cult deprogramming effort, the Saudi program puts convicted terrorists through weeks of intensive group and individual discussions with Muslim clerics and therapists who try to convince them of their errors in thinking. Then they're set free and monitored by Saudi secret police. The program, officially called the Advisory Committee Program, is being watched worldwide. And joining us from the studios of NPR member station WAMU in Washington, D.C. is Terrence Henry, staff editor for The Atlantic. His article on the program, Get Out of Jihad Free, appears in the current issue of the magazine. Terrence, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
There's a lot of fun to be had, you know, with this, because it does feel like people are, you know, somewhat playing a board game. But this is serious business, and the Saudis are claiming great success with this. What are some of the numbers?
Well, so far there have been about 1,500 people that have entered into a reform program that takes place in the Saudi prisons. And the Saudi authorities claim that they have released 500 of them, and that none of those people have gone on to do any further terrorist acts. And as far as you can tell, so far that's true.
Well, you write that before September 11th, 2001, the targets of terrorist attacks in Saudi Arabia were largely foreigners. But after 9/11, attacks became more indiscriminate, and militants began attacking the Saudi regime. The Saudi government began rounding up terrorists and offered amnesty to some. Now, this rehabilitation program is a result of that. How does the program work?
It's a comprehensive program to reform the terrorists, as opposed to other countries who have dealt with al-Qaeda prisoners by essentially locking them up and throwing away the key. The Saudis decided to combat al-Qaeda's ideology with the ideology of what they say is, you know, true Islam. So the prisoners that came in to this program were first interrogated, and then they would go into sessions with psychologists and psychiatrists who would provide them therapeutic treatment. And on top of that, they would also meet with clerics one-on-one, and as well as in groups. And essentially, these clerics came in and would use Islam as a way to refute the ideology of al-Qaeda.
Now, why did they choose this way of doing it? As you said, instead of, let's say, just locking people up or interrogating them, they're using this, you know, almost, well, sort of reverse brainwashing, much like people are deprogrammed from cult. What does it say about how Saudi officials view al-Qaeda that they chose this way?
I think it says a couple of things. One is that they obviously view al-Qaeda as a deviant group. And if you look at the statements that come out of the kingdom, a lot of the time they won't even refer to them as al-Qaeda. They'll just call them the cult or the deviants. And I think it does two things. For one, it helps them in the eyes of the Saudi people, because they're showing that, you know, the Saudi government, the ruling family, are the true protectors of Islam. And they're the ones who are, fighting the real battle against al-Qaeda. And it also makes it to be more of an external problem and not something that's rooted within the actual ideology of the Saudi regime.
Well, it's interesting because we remember speaking with political scientist Robert Pape from the University of Chicago. He had his 2005 book on suicide terrorists, in which he said, you know, what motivates a suicide bomber, for instance, or someone who would join up with al-Qaeda to become a suicide bomber, is foreign occupation. You, in your article, quote an American terrorism expert who says loneliness is the root cause. And it sounds as if maybe the Saudi officials are going with that second reasoning.
It appears that way. I mean, in al-Qaeda's eyes, the occupation of Saudi Arabia by the ruling family is something of a foreign occupation. Al-Qaeda has made the argument that the Saudi regime is apostate and that they don't deserve, essentially, to rule the kingdom, the Holy Land. The Saudi officials have taken the view that, you know, al-Qaeda is a cult and it's an aberrant ideology and it leads people astray.
Well, let's find out who the joiners are. You spoke with the family of one graduate of the Jihad Rehab Program, again, officially called the Advisory Committee Program. for your writing purposes, you call him Ali. What did you find out about who he was, you know, before he went into Al-Qaeda?
He was a student in Saudi Arabia, and he was someone who came across online some publications of Al-Qaeda inside Saudi Arabia. And he started, you know, cutting quotes from the magazines and putting them other places on the web. He would forward the electronic magazines to his friends. And, I mean, what I say in the piece is that he essentially became a blogger for Al-Qaeda.
Mm. He was working at his computer one day when, as you write, police arrived and took him away. Was there ever any allegation that he took part in a terrorist attack? Or, you know, what was it alleged that he did? Just become, as you said, the blogger for Al-Qaeda?
Well, Ali had essentially, like many people in the kingdom, had flirted with Al-Qaeda's ideology. He had really only been doing this for a couple of months when he was arrested. And so he was kind of one of those cases where the government had a real opportunity to turn him around from that. There are several, you know, actual hardcore leaders of Al-Qaeda who are deeply involved in the operational aspects of the organization who this program probably wouldn't work for. But for, you know, the untold numbers of guys like Ali who join Al-Qaeda online, so to speak, this is an actual viable option that, you know, so far really seems to have worked.
Well, tell us more about this program. The Financial Times, which also wrote about it, says that the families of some of the participants are paid up to $1,500 a month so that they won't be vulnerable to Al-Qaeda paying them as well. And, you know, participants are sometimes given lavish gifts. We mentioned cars and money. But what happens in these exchanges between, let's say, the Muslim clerics and a would-be terrorist?
Well, the group sessions are typically speeches by clerics. And when these clerics come into the prisons, it's quite an experience for the detainees because these are people that they've known and respected their whole lives. They're quite popular in the kingdom. They're essentially, like one person I talked to said, rock stars. And so to see these people come in and to say, look, you've completely lost your way, you're, you know, interpreting Islam in a deviant way, it can have a shattering effect on them. And so what they do is essentially point by point in the one-on-one sessions refute each justification that the detainee can come up with for enacting terrorism.
What do they say? How do they know it's worked? I mean, is there a point where somebody slaps their head and says, oh, you're right? I mean, how do they figure out if somebody is really changing their mind about Al-Qaeda or doing that just to get out?
Well, I think an important distinction to make is that these people aren't walking out of the prisons suddenly saying, you know, I love America, I love Israel, I hate Al-Qaeda. They are, in a sense, many of them still fundamentalist. However, they have renounced violence. And that is kind of the key point that the program works on, is to show them that violence is not a part of Islam. And as far as we can tell, you know, they've had success in this and that they've released people who haven't gone on to carry out any terrorist attacks.
And the Saudis also say they have psychiatrists who can sort of weed out the fakers, the people just saying what the Saudis want to hear in order to get out. And we're talking with Terrence Henry, staff editor for The Atlantic. His article, Get Out of Jihad Free, appears in the current issue. When we come back, does he think that jihad rehab can be used in the U.S.? That's after a quick break, Here and Now. It's Here and Now. We're back with Terrence Henry, staff editor for The Atlantic magazine. His article, Get Out of Jihad Free, appears in this month's edition. It's about how the government of Saudi Arabia is attempting to rehabilitate accused terrorists through financial incentives and talk therapy using Muslim clerics and psychologists. It's a program the U.S. government is watching closely. Terrence, you were telling us about the young man you call Ali, a 22-year-old who was arrested by the Saudi government for blogging about Al-Qaeda. He was released after 4 months of counseling. He and other graduates are then followed by Saudi secret police?
Yeah, and there's a kind of extensive and somewhat lengthy parole process for the prisoners when they are released. For each individual, the experience is going to be different. For someone like Ali, who is pretty low level and didn't really even know what he was getting into, it's not going to take long to kind of put him through the program. For someone else who may have gone either to Afghanistan or Iraq to fight, it would probably be a different story. And, you know, that type of individual would be much more closely monitored once they were released from prison. But in the case of Ali, he would come in on a regular basis and meet with his, in essence, parole officer. And this his officer would ask him, you know, who he had been meeting with and who he had talked to and what he had been up to. And in Ali's case, it was a pretty simple answer. He'd gone back to school, and he had gotten really interested in trading Saudi oil stocks.
This seems like a tricky road to hoe for the Saudis in that they're not neutral in the fight against terrorism. Of course, they're supporting the U.S., but they also have been criticized. They have critics who say they have a lack of democracy and secret police. And they've also supported jihad in other cases. I mean, jihad isn't necessarily a pejorative to the Saudis.
That's true. And in the case of sending fighters to Afghanistan in the 80s, that was definitely seen as a legitimate act of jihad. But it was something that the government condoned. So I think in this case, yeah, they are walking a bit of a fine line, especially with what's happening next door in Iraq. They are having difficulties preventing fighters from going over there and participating in the insurgency. And in fact, they're trying to build a large security fence along the Iraq-Saudi Arabian border.
Well, that raises another question because, some might ask, and we do want to ask, what's the sense that this program can be transferred to other places, Guantanamo, for instance? There's another interesting note. We've spoken about how part of the program is to try to find jobs for the graduates of the deprogramming or at least give them some money. But we understand that they also get help in finding wives because the thinking is that once a possible terrorist is married, he'll settle down.
Right. And this is something that I think deserves a little more debate, whether or not being married actually, you know, makes these people less inclined to terrorism. It certainly seems like with the actual hardcore leadership of al-Qaeda, you know, being married or, you know, even being married to multiple wives hasn't, you know, led them to give up violence. But in the case of the detainees coming out of the program who are more similar to, you know, the case of Ali, who was basically a blogger for al-Qaeda as opposed to someone like Osama bin Laden, they're going to try and encourage them to settle themselves as much as they can. So they're going to reconnect them with their families. They're going to have their families tell them that, you know, what they were doing was wrong. They're going to make sure that the family and the individual is taken care of financially. They're going to help them get jobs. And, you know, as the case merits, they'll help them pay for their weddings and that sort of thing. So the idea is to get them back into society as much as possible, since their view is that al-Qaeda has effectively, you know, taken them out of Saudi society.
So bottom line, is there, you know, what can the U.S. take from these programs?
That's a good question. I think one thing the U.S. can take away is that we might not be the best people to deal with some of the prisoners that we've taken in the war on terrorism. In, you know, some cases, it might be better to turn these people back over to their home countries. And I think with Guantanamo Bay, you're starting to see that. A couple hundred people have been released to their home countries. And I think somewhere around 80% of those have been released upon the time they return home. You know, if that had taken place earlier on, you know, it might have been a different story as far as how these people feel about the United States today. I think the biggest lesson that the United States can take away is that they're, in addition to the war on terrorism, as the administration calls it, you know, seeing that as a military and intelligence operation, there is the war of ideas. And there is a way, as the Saudis have demonstrated, to combat al-Qaeda's ideology. And I don't think, you know, the U.S. can use American Muslim clerics to try and convince, you know, Saudi militants that they've gone wrong. But they certainly could encourage and help support programs like the Saudis are doing. And it, like I say in the piece, it might be worth looking at in other parts of the world, places like Pakistan and potentially Western Europe in the future. There are a large number of Muslims in prisons in Britain. These are places where you could, you know, approach the local Muslim clerics and see if there is any way to have them come in and talk to the prisoners and see what comes of it.
And has anybody raised any questions of, you know, the civil rights of the prisoners? As despicable as al-Qaeda's actions might be, you know, the idea of state-sponsored brainwashing, is that, or even if it's reverse brainwashing, is anyone worried about that?
I think that's definitely a concern. The prison where, or at least one of the prisons where this program takes place, which is the Al-Hayir prison south of Riyadh, has long been known as a prison where, you know, communist and reformist and those against the regime basically disappear. However, this program, according to the Saudi government, is voluntary. And so you're not forced to go into it. And actually, they want to make sure before you go into it that you're serious about it. So they do have a couple of rounds of sessions with psychiatrists before you, you know, join the program to make sure that it's actually something that you'd, you know, take seriously before you go into it.
Terrence Henry, staff editor for The Atlantic, his article, Get Out of Jihad Free, appears in the current issue of that magazine. Terrence, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, quick look ahead. Tomorrow on Here and Now, Cuban officials have yanked the press credentials of three veteran journalists. We'll ask one, why? Also, what vitamins are you taking? Well, you may be chucking some when you hear the latest research. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, how to measure progress in Iraq? A database? Some sort of metrics? Or is it just something you know it when you see it? Back after the news, Here and Now. Young, it's Here and Now. U.S. and Iraqi forces fought with suspected Sunni insurgents today during a massive search for three missing American soldiers in a volatile area south of Baghdad. An al-Qaeda front group claimed it captured the soldiers Saturday during an attack on a U.S. convoy in the so-called Triangle of Death, a longtime al-Qaeda stronghold. Meanwhile, the tone of the debate over the war has shifted, with more Republicans expressing their frustration and their concerns that next year's elections may be a referendum similar to the elections last fall. A group of Republicans met with President Bush last week to warn him, as the New York Times put it, "We're with you now, but if there is no progress by September, all bets are off." Well, how do you measure that progress? Julian Zelitzer is professor of history at Boston University. He's joining us in the studio to give us some context here. Welcome, Julian, as always.
Thanks for having me.
And first of all, how significant is it historically that more of the president's party, you know, the party in power, speaking out, Karl Rove, enraged that that meeting was leaked?
It's very important. I mean, in the past, you've had parties that were more divided, so it wasn't unusual for a Republican to take on a Republican president. But under George Bush, Republicans have been extremely united. No one has broken from the party. And now we're really hearing the first serious rumblings that many members, not just people running for president, are not happy.
Well, September, as we're hearing, is crucial. That's when General David Petraeus, the new U.S. commander in Iraq, and Ryan Crocker, the new U.S. ambassador to Iraq, are scheduled to deliver what the White House calls the only progress report that matters on Iraq. But as you all know, others are questioning this. You know, how do you define progress? We read this weekend about the Brookings Institution Iraq Index. We hear from them occasionally. It's a compilation of everything from monthly car bomb rates to kidnappings and internet access. But, you know, others are questioning Jack Kingston of Georgia, the Republican congressman, has been distributing the Iraqi index to fellow lawmakers, asking them to come up with a bipartisan metric based on that. Is that possible?
No, it's very difficult. Secretary of Defense McNamara in the 60s always tried to measure everything and measure whether we were winning in Vietnam or losing. And eventually he became a parody of himself because the public was a lot smarter than the numbers would suggest. And they understood things were going badly. And especially when you don't have a battle where there's any clear victory. You're talking about reconstructing civil society right now. It's very hard to put a number on when you're done. And I think the administration is in a bit of a trap in that it's very hard to prove they are getting to where they want to be. And at the same time, politically, that's exactly what they have to do.
And Susan Collins, the Republican senator from Maine, says one man's progress may be another man's failure, and that the September analysis will be mixed, which won't be good enough for her to keep this open-ended troop commitment in Iraq. How, again, you know, what do you think they are factoring in?
Look, I think for most Republicans right now, they want a cessation of the violence. That's a very key factor. Some sense that the political system is working in Iraq. And three, ironically, they need a withdrawal schedule. The Republicans need, not just the Democrats, because I think that's part of what normalcy will look like to Americans. And until those three things are on the table, I think it's going to be hard for the White House to convince Americans we're almost out.
Others have said that they just want to be able to see things like people going to the market, people walking around, people being able to live their lives, that kind of, you know, as we said, you know it when you see it kind of thing.
That's very hard and virtually impossible for that to happen within a year, given the kinds of violence we're seeing there. Anyone who's followed the Middle East knows that, you know, those scenes with cafes and people outside are always coupled with a bombing. That's what we have in Iraq right now. So if that's the measure they're looking for, they're unlikely to succeed.
Right. Do you think it's likely that there might be a bill that the president won't veto that might call for tying more funding to benchmarks, progress from the Iraqi government, but also withdrawal deadlines? We're seeing a lot of shifts. We're seeing this week a U.S. government that's suddenly going to be in talks with Iran, something they said they'd never do. So do you think it's possible there might be a bill tied to withdrawal?
I don't know if we're going to have it now, but I think when the fall funding debates start, we might. A lot, despite the rhetoric being exactly the same from the Bush administration, you do see things changing. Not just Republicans complaining, but Bush saying maybe benchmarks are okay, to the Iraqi government itself calling for a withdrawal, and to these discussions with Iran, Syria. Something's changing. And, you know, Bush is not tone deaf, and he understands how the political winds which way they're blowing right now. And so I suspect by the fall you might see movement in that direction if nothing dramatic has happened in a positive sense.
The Republican leader in the U.S. Senate, Kentucky's Mitch McConnell, calls the Iraqi government a huge disappointment, and he and others are in a bind. You know, they want to support the president, but they want to keep their jobs. Is it impossible to keep politics out of this debate? Nebraska Senator Chuck Hagel, a Republican, a huge critic of the war in Iraq, a Vietnam vet, said yesterday on CBS's Face the Nation, "Wars should never be held up as a partisan issue." But is that possible?
No, they always are. I mean, even though we like to think that politics stops at the water's edge, the famous saying by Senator Vandenberg, that never happens. And in some ways, we want politics to be part of the debate. That means our democracy is debating the war rather than just having a war. And this is healthy. In some ways, the convergence of the election of 2008 with this unfolding debate about funding might be the best thing that happened to the nation. Whether you're for or against it, we're starting to finally debate, where do we go from here? How does this end?
And the script isn't entirely written. We read yesterday in the Boston Globe a terrific article about how Iranians are glancing over at Iraq and seeing stumbling democracy, seeing Shiite clerics staying out of the government, and they're looking over and they're liking what they see. So there may be other shifts that we can't predict in the region. We want to stick with Chuck Hagel, though. He was also asked that if he runs for president, would he do so as a Republican or an independent? He says he's always been a Republican. He voted Republican when he was serving in Vietnam in 68. But here's what else he said.
I'm not happy with the Republican Party today. It has drifted from the party of Eisenhower, of Goldwater, of Reagan, the party that I joined. It isn't the same party.
Cagle went on to say the Republican Party has been hijacked by a group of single-minded, almost isolationist power projectors. That's pretty strong talk, but he's been known for strong talk. How would you position his talk?
I think you're hearing that from a lot of Republicans right now, not just moderates, but Republicans on the right. There's a feeling that the party has really moved away from its principles and it's engaged in a war that is politically a loser. That said, I'm not sure, you know, he will break as an independent. You know, Hagel, if he really wants to win, has to win as a Republican. And so that's the tension a lot of Republicans are going to face. How far do you move yourself from a party that has become a political problem without losing the apparatus that the party brings you for an election?
You think there's no possibility for a Chuck Hagel independent run, maybe with a Mayor Bloomberg from New York as his running mate, as some have suggested? What do you think of that?
It's possible, but still, politically, that's very hard. I mean, if he really senses he can win, his best shot is to do it as a Republican. Reagan rejected an offer to run as an independent, and he decided to stay in the Republican Party and to transform it. I think that's the kind of mentality it's more predictable, you'll see.
Julian Zelitzer, professor of history at Boston University, helping us, as he always does, take the temperature, this time of the Republican Party. Julian, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Well, still to come before we go, Israeli bassist Avishai Cohen, on many things, including his musical inspiration and idol, the late Jaco Pastorius, the American bass player. We'll get to hear some of his music as well. You're listening to Here and Now. Voters in Oregon have till tomorrow to decide whether to tax themselves more. That's usually a slam dunk no, but some Oregonians are facing a unique challenge: how to pay for libraries, police officers, social services that were once paid for by their now depleted timber industry. Joining us is Jessica Robinson. She's news director at Jefferson Public Radio in Ashland, Oregon. And Jessica, first of all, explain, so how did it come to be that county funds in Oregon came from trees?
Well, in Oregon, it's kind of a convoluted backstory. Originally, there were these large swaths of public land that was given to a railroad company. And the idea was that the railroad company was supposed to sell this public land to the private sector to bring more people to the state and to fund the building of the railroad to the California border. Well, the railroad didn't quite do that exactly the way they were supposed to. And so the federal government, around the turn of the century, took back a lot of that land. And eventually it was decided that since this land wasn't in the private sector, the counties weren't making taxes off of it, that when there were timber harvests, the counties would get a portion of the receipts of the money that came from the timber harvest.
And that worked quite well for a while. I mean, it pretty much funded the counties. That then what happened?
Well, then the timber industry started changing. There was a limit, and the trees became smaller, the ones that they were able to harvest. And then the environmental movement was successful in getting the amount of timber that would be harvested on federal land severely curtailed because of concerns about spotted owls and about what was happening to Oregon's forests in general. And so Congress approved this program that's been in place for the last 6 years that would give counties what they used to earn from the logging on federal forests.
We understand, it sort of subsidized it, but we understand that stopped. And the impact has been that, well, we understand, for instance, all of the libraries are closed in Jackson County?
Yes.
What else is impacted by this loss of funds?
The other services, roads, public safety, those are things that are also being cut. And so we're going to see fewer patrols, fewer jail beds, fewer jail staff. The public safety is going to go down.
What are voters being asked to consider? How much of a tax?
Well, my understanding is that for the average in Jackson County, for the average property owner, it would be about $110 a year additionally in taxes.
And that's going to be tough for some people. Well, we understand that in Oregon, you know, the state has changed. There's a lot more people, as you said, a lot less trees to harvest. But we were thinking that, you know, we're here in Massachusetts. This would be as if the federal government ran the fishing industry here, you know, and we depended on those proceeds. And we're now watching fish stocks being depleted and areas being cut off, you know, so that the fish can replenish. Are people asking why public officials maybe didn't see this coming?
Yeah, and it's interesting because public officials did see it coming. They knew that this program was going to expire. But I think a lot of people, public officials and the general public who were aware of this program, they expected Congress to pass an extension of it, and then they didn't last year, and then the new Congress came in, and they didn't pass an extension, and then there was an extension approved, but it was put in the controversial Iraq spending bill, and so there's been no extension, and now we're turning in our ballots, and we need to vote on whether we're going to fund the libraries or not.
So what's the thinking for the future, Jessica? There is the vote. People are voting by letter ballot, and their last opportunity is tomorrow. What's the thinking here that, you know, maybe they'll just treat this in a short-term way, but then hope that the federal government steps back in with the subsidies or just completely change the framework of financing in Oregon?
Well, I think that people are sort of realizing that there does need to be a change in how funding happens. And there's actually a proposal to take this public land and put half in conservation, you know, conserve it for the ecological value, and take the other half and sell the timber on it and put that into trust funds that will help fund the counties that depend on or have traditionally depended on timber for years to come. And, of course, that's a controversial proposal because it involves selling public land.
Jessica Robinson, news director at Jefferson Public Radio in Ashland, Oregon. Jessica, thank you.
Thank you.
Still ahead, the music of Israel's Avishai Cohen, Here and Now.
Yeah.
Young, It's Here and Now. Avishai Cohen is a master of the slow burn. The Israeli-born bassist, composer, and bandleader writes and performs with an intensity that draws from a long musical pedigree of styles, including the Sephardic traditions of his Israeli heritage. Cohen began leading his own band after playing with Chick Corea, Danilo Perez, and Brad Meldow, and now the intensity of his performance has been bottled on a live CD-DVD release called As Is, Live at the Blue Note, and Avishai Cohen joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And we were just listening to Bass Suite No. 1, and you know, it reminds me, you said that you play with great agility, and I understand you studied the piano first. Well, why the switch?
You know, I was in my teens. I was actually living in St. Louis when I was 14 years old, and I had a friend there that was listening to a lot of rock and got me into it, and I wanted to explore something else, and I, till this day, I would not be able to tell you exactly how and why I picked the electric bass. It just kind of happened.
Yeah, well, and I wonder, though, if it had anything to do with the first time you heard a bass player named Jaco Pastorius.
That had to do a lot with it. Once I heard Jaco, my world had changed.
I read somewhere that you said you became Jaco. Let's remind people, Jaco Pastorius, the wonderful bass player who died way too young. Mm-hmm. He was actually beaten by bouncers, but he had a drug problem. And here he is playing on Joni Mitchell's 1976 album, Hijira. Bill Mikowski, who wrote the biography on Jaco, wrote the liner notes for As Is. When you look back and realize that this is a musician who had inspired you, and now some of the same people are paying attention to you that did to him.
Sometimes I get comments by people that know Jaco's music and say, I hear some of his spirit in your music, or, you know, that's always a great compliment. I feel that there's very few people in my life other than my parents and my close family that just live in me, mm-hmm. and are a part of my personality in some other way. And he's one. I don't need to listen to him anymore or to transcribe anything. He's in me.
Well, a little more about you. You were born in a kibbutz in Israel, emigrated to New York to play professionally in 92. As you said, somewhere in there, you also lived in the States. Your 2005 CD At Home, though, commemorated a return to living in Israel. What is it that drew you back? I mean, family, obviously, but...
It's almost like us touring musicians, we live in a big festival. We play many festivals, we play until late at night, and we live a very, you can say, crazy or charged type of life. And then to go back to New York after a tour is almost like to go back to a festival. To me was, I love nature, and for me, nature charges me. And to me, to go back to New York after a tour was not healthy.
Well, now you're back in Israel, although obviously still touring. How does being in Israel change your musical identity at all? Does it?
It's hard to tell, but when I'm in Israel, I am closer to my heritage or my roots, which maybe bring out some more of that.
Well, in fact, you said that you want to get deeper into the Middle Eastern roots of you and music. Let's listen to a little of that vibe, if you will. It's from the new CD. It's called Fidiam. So tell me what I'm hearing here that would sound Middle Eastern.
Well, it's hard to say. I never put my finger on something and say that sounds like Bach or that's, you know. Yeah. But it's something in the vibe that comes from some rhythms that are not even rhythms that I hear by the influence of Turkish, Greek, and Moroccan music. It's hinted, you know. It's not like... this is it, you know, and everything I write, there's hints and things that kind of bring you there and don't really force you to be anywhere. There's some Coltrane influences here. There's some funk influences. For instance, this vamp here. It's a mixture of things. Is that I wouldn't know what to call it, you know?
But how does it work in Israel? Do you play with Arab and Palestinian musicians?
Not really. No. It's a very sensitive subject, and as much as I would like to, or some people would like to, it usually doesn't happen, and when it happens, it's tricky. Mm. And it's not easy to just say, oh, let's through the music, you know.
Yeah.
It's a dream, and sometimes it happens, and sometimes it works, but it's difficult. By just being there and soaking that atmosphere and that culture, I am a part of that. There is an Arab in me, too, seriously, in the most beautiful way. We don't have to play together, necessarily, to have some of each other's soul, you can say, you know.
Tell me a story that illustrates that difficulty.
Well, as I've been digging up my roots, selecting material, I've bumped into an incredible recording of an angel-like singer, a Muslim Arabic girl that lives in Israel that sings traditional Palestinian music that I thought, wow, that would be amazing as a part of the project. And I actually took that and combined that with a song that I wrote, and it became an incredible little track. And then I tracked down that girl.
Because you loved it. I mean, what did that music do to you?
Oh, no. When I heard her, I cried. And my hair was standing. I said, I got to get this today. Got the recording, listened to it about 50 times a day until I was inspired to write a tune over that.
Mm-hmm.
And looked for that girl, found her to get her approval and hopefully get her excited about it as I am. And she couldn't hear herself in a situation like that. I think she was afraid of what her community would think, and of them not accepting it too. And it was very sad. It was very, very disappointing to me.
Just because you were Jewish
because of all of what happens between us and them, or the Arabic community and the, you know, the more of the Palestinians and the Israelis. And I totally understand it, actually. I can't blame her. I would love for it to be different and for her to be a little above that and see the potential of the music embracing those things and actually making a change. But she couldn't accept it, and I could understand it, although I was very, very devastated for the loss of the music and the opportunity for the world or whoever is going to hear it and feel what I felt.
Yeah. Huh. Well, that's fascinating. Something not every musician has to consider, you know?
Oh, yeah, that's for sure.
Well, we want to end with one of your ballads. It's a lovely tune. It's called Remembering, but we were curious, remembering what?
Anything you want to remember if you want, or you don't have to.
Okay. Musician, composer, band leader, co-founder of Razdaz Records, Avishai Cohen. For more on Avishai's tour and the CD-DVD release as is live at the Blue Note, go to our website, here-now.org. Avishai, thanks so much.
It's my pleasure.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.